Okay, hi everybody. I want to get started because, as you can tell, this is a huge panel for a concurrent session at SEJ, something I've gotten a lot of flack for in the last couple of days with the SEJ organizers. I'm Dina Capiello. I cover energy and environment for the AP out of Washington, and it's my duty today to bring a piece of the Beltway to Miami. A lot's happening on the Beltway, as you know, on environmental issues and on the campaign trail, especially the Republican primary. We have a very distinguished panel today. How this is going to work is I'm going to do a very brief introduction of each of the speakers. Their bios are online. I'm sure you can Google it. And then I'm going to do a brief intro for those who are not obsessed with things happening inside the Beltway about what's kind of been happening. And I'm going to turn it over to the speakers. Given how many speakers that we have, we're going to run it like a congressional committee, which is a five-minute opening statement. I will time it. I don't have, you know, the green, yellow, red light, but those who know me know that I can stop people from talking. And then we're going to go to questions, because I think that's probably going to be the most interesting. As I said, I picked these six individuals because I don't think that issues are ever black and white. There's never just two sides to a story. All Republicans are on board with what the Republicans are doing in the House of Representatives. You'll hear that today. So starting with my left, Mike McKenna is a GOP strategist in D.C., represents folks like Southern Company and the Koch brothers. If you don't know who the Koch brothers are, look it up.
Spell it.
Right next to Mike is Steve Brown. Steve Brown is the executive director of the Environmental Council of the States. I brought Steve here for a very particular purpose. I understand that a lot of you don't cover what I cover, which is national environmental policy. He's going to kind of bring it down to the regional and state level, what this means for everybody out there in Minnesota, California, Texas, you know, everywhere across the country. Immediately to my left is Lisa Henserling, who's now a law professor at Georgetown, my alma mater, and also just left the EPA as policy chief for EPA Administrator Lisa Jackson. Very happy to have her here. To my right is David Jenkins. He's director of government affairs for Republicans for Environmental Protection, a group that in D.C. has actually been railing against what some of the House Republicans are doing on environmental regulations. To his right is David Goldston with NRDC, now Director of Government Affairs there. For those of you who don't know David, he was the former Chief of Staff for Sherry Bollert, a very moderate Green Republican during the Gingrich Revolution, which appears a lot of what we're seeing today, very similar. And then to my far right is Michael Bruhn, Executive Director of the Sierra Club. So please welcome them. This is a quite distinguished panel, and I'm really glad that they're all here. So just to give you guys a two-minute, you know, AP Cliff Notes perspective on what's going on in D.C., over the last few weeks, I've spent most of my time watching the Republican-controlled House pass bills to roll back EPA regulations. Just in the last 3 weeks, they've passed bills to send back to the EPA and delay pollution reductions at cement kilns, industrial boilers, coal-fired power plants. That followed early efforts to basically exempt greenhouse gases from the Clean Air Act and prevent regulation under the Clean Air Act. Lisa actually argued MAS versus EPA, so I think she's probably going to get into that, the Supreme Court case that found that the Clean Air Act could be used to regulate greenhouse gases. And then late last week, just before I left for a brief vacation, I wrote a story about how the House Republicans and some Democrats, but it's mostly a Republican effort. I think Mike will probably talk about that, but are now going after regulations that really aren't even there yet, that the EPA is still considering and are kind of being preemptive about it. And the latest effort was on coal ash, basically preventing the EPA from regulating it at hazardous waste. They have not decided what they're going to do, but saying that states should regulate it as a solid waste. The bills alone, obviously, have very little chance of getting past the Democratic-controlled Senate, although they will have probably some support, but probably not enough to overcome a filibuster. That's the bills alone. But I'm going to tell you now, you're going to see these things on every must-pass piece of legislation that has to get to the, as riders, and that's going to be one attempt. And then if that fails, they will start attacking budgets and parts of the budget to prevent EPA from having any money to do what they're allowed to under the law. So there's many possibilities. The bills are just the first, then they go to riders, and then to budget. This panel will examine, I hope, today, why this is happening, the administration's response, the Obama administration's response to what's happening, and what the impact is for people that live in various states and regions when these regulations don't come to fruition. I think that you will soon see that no one on this panel is happy. I think everybody's a little ticked off about what's happening in various ways. And on some level, the strategy is working. I mean, Obama, just before Labor Day, the Friday before Labor Day, tabled an update to ozone standards that his own EPA administrator said was indefensible for economic reasons. As you all know, the Clean Air Act, for setting an act, so you cannot actually consider costs when you set a national ambient air quality standard. And just yesterday, the EPA signaled that they were going to start looking at a rule to regulate fracking wastewater, but that was not going to happen until after the election. They won't even propose one until 2013. And then in an op-ed today in the LA Times, Lisa Jackson said that the GOP was acting like they are too dirty to fail, these companies, but it is unclear how deep her support runs in the White House. So that's where we are. I hope that's a pretty good summary to start, and I'm going to turn it over to Mike McKenna. And Mike, my dear, you only have 5 minutes. And use the mic, please.
I'm only going to take one. Everyone always asks, why now? Why these set of issues? Why are the Republicans in the House, depending on what you think about it, getting distracted or doing what they're doing? And the answer is because, well, it's like Willie Keeler said when he was asked why he robbed banks. What did he say?
Where the money is.
Because that's where the money is. Before you scribble that down, here and now, because the rules are here and now. They're not a year from now. They weren't a year ago. They're here now. If you look at EPA's regulatory stream, for a variety of reasons, it's all come together here in the last year and will continue to come together in the next 18 months. So I don't think this is a fight that the House Republicans chose. I don't think it's one they wanted, but it's one that came to them. The second thing, what am I at? Am I at 45 seconds, Tina?
Well, you have a good 4 minutes.
Keep on okay. Going. The second thing is, I remember a conversation with a Republican elected official in Illinois who was pulling his hair out in the summer of 2010 about why those dimwits in Delaware had been dopey enough to nominate, what's her name?
Christine O'Donnell.
Christine what?
O'Donnell.
Thank you, O'Donnell, right? Instead of the eminently qualified Mike Castle. He was really mad at them. And I asked him, well, why do you think they did that? Why do you think they did that? What sense does that make? He's like, because they're morons. I'm like, well, that's an interesting answer, but let's see if we can't get a better one. It's because the voters didn't want Mike Castle. If the Republicans in the House were getting electoral blowback, this would stop tomorrow morning. They're not getting blowback. They're getting encouragement. And if you have some doubt about that, take a look at what's going on in the White House. I'm just scribbling down what I could think of while Dina was talking, and I'm not really smart. So the president took a pass on an ozone standard that, as Dina pointed out, his own EPA administrator called indefensible. Jeepers. Suddenly it became defensible. He announced that, you know what, we're not going to get to those new source performance standards for power plants for greenhouse gases. Well, when are you going to get to them, Mr. President? Well, we're going to get to them 2013, somewhere in that neighborhood. The Boiler Mac. The Republicans aren't the ones who rolled back the Boiler Mac. The EPA stayed the Boiler Mac because it was a disaster. 316B. I didn't send a letter to Rob Andrews saying, you know what, we're going to be okay with the impingement standards. Nancy Stoner sent that letter. Keystone. I'm not the one who's going to approve Keystone XL. The administration's going to approve Keystone XL. And on the Utility MACT, I'm not the one who's going to make the deal at the last minute with the utilities on Utility MACT. The president's going to make that deal. Why? Why? Well, everybody in places like, anybody work for Politico here? Yeah. Okay, so people who write for Politico, National Journal? Yeah. Anybody who works for Politico or National Journal is going to write, well, because he's clearing the decks for the election. Huh. What does that mean? If these things are such great big giant winners, why are we trying to get rid of them before the election? Shouldn't we be jumping up and down saying, hey, we did this, this is awesome. We kick ass and we take names. So as you think about this, I encourage you to think, why? Why does the administration do what it does? Why does EPA do what it does? And why do the Republicans in Congress do what they do? Time?
Just about.
Yep.
Thank you, Mike. Lisa, why don't you go next?
If he has any extra time, can I take it?
Absolutely. I yield the balance of my time.
Really small technical point, but I don't want it to go uncorrected. I did not argue the case in Massachusetts versus EPA. I merely wrote the briefs. I just want to put a legal perspective on today's panel, which is that the rules that EPA is undertaking, and there are many, and they are important, and they are economically and environmentally consequential, those rules are required by law. The most important and the most controversial of these rules, the boilers rule, Mike just referred to the utility rule, the rules on greenhouse gases, those rules are required by law. If someone wants to come in and change that, whether it's the individual congressman, whether it's the EPA administrator, or whether it is the president himself, then they must change the law. And until that happens, EPA must go forward with those rules. In addition, in many cases, those rules are surrounded by legal restrictions, either in the statutes themselves, in particular the Clean Air Act is what we're talking about, I think, a lot this morning, or in decisions interpreting the Clean Air Act. So that if you think EPA is being precise, rigid, technical, in many cases, those requirements are put in place through the law. If you want to change those requirements, go ahead. But you must go back to Congress before doing that. Let me give you one example. In 2007, the Supreme Court said to EPA, you have the authority to regulate greenhouse gases. This is the Massachusetts versus EPA case. In addition, if you are going to decline to regulate greenhouse gases, you must speak in terms relevant to the statutory instruction. You may not simply say, I'm busy, it's so very complicated, things are uncertain, I'm washing my hair that day. You may not say that. You must speak in the language of the statute. What is the language does the statute speak? The language it's spoken is science. Once EPA sits down, as it has done in response to that ruling, and decides that greenhouse gases endanger public health and welfare, then a set of legal consequences flows from that decision. Then EPA was required to regulate automobiles. The requirement to regulate automobiles itself triggered a requirement to regulate stationary sources on a case-by-case basis. And on down the line, EPA may not simply stop at some point and say, boy, are we tired, we're done now. The political heat is too heavy, we're done now. And so the backdrop, I think, to all of this to understand what EPA is doing is partly to understand that they're doing what they're doing because the law tells them to do that. Let me close by talking about ozone for 1 minute because I think this point provides a counterpoint. The National Ambient Air Quality Standards of the Clean Air Act are unique in the following respect in environmental law. They are backed up by a unanimous Supreme Court ruling in the year 2000. I was also involved litigating that case on behalf of some states that said EPA may not consider costs and technological feasibility in setting those standards. It must rely on the science alone. And so I must say, to have the President of the United States require the Environmental Protection Agency to withdraw an ozone air quality standard on the basis of costs and regulatory uncertainty, which is another way of saying costs, is astonishing. And it's astonishing because, in my view at least, it's unlawful. And what that does to the rest of the program is it says it's okay sometimes to intervene and not follow the law, and then in other cases we'll say, oh, but we're following the law. I think that's a very difficult position to maintain. And so I guess I'd close with the question, if the White House is not willing to support a standard, again, unique in environmental law, where we have a unanimous Supreme Court ruling construing it not to allow the consideration of costs, if the President is not willing to stand up for that program, then I am very anxious to understand what program he will stand up for. Thank you.
Thank you, Lisa. And for those of you guys who don't know, just a little addendum to what Lisa just said, the EPA has been sued over the tabling of the ozone standard as unlawful by a bunch of environmental groups. So that's already in the courts. Next is David Goldston.
So let's see. Already plenty to react to. I've been asked to give some historical perspective for starters. So I would say that the one thing to understand about the assault that the House Republicans have been running against environmental law is, to some degree, yes, there were all these rules that were coming up and therefore the agenda was laid out, but that makes it a little too simple, and I don't think even they would claim that that's all that was happening. That's the amount of time I got from Lisa, right? I've run a lot of congressional hearings. So to some degree, they had this agenda come to them, but they didn't just sort of say, well, we've got to deal with that. What they've done is make this the central platform of their entire agenda for the fall, arguing that this is their jobs program, even though there's no evidence that this will have any consequential effect on jobs. So they could have done what Mike suggested, but that's not what they're doing, and that's not what they're claiming to do. Secondly, when they go after these rules, they aren't just changing or blocking the specific rules. They are actually going beyond that and using that as a way to hide what they're, or to obscure what the other parts of the legislation are doing, which is changing the fundamental law. For example, the House had a 10-minute debate to change the 40-year-old way the Clean Air Act works, which Lisa talked about requiring health standards. I hesitate to how I phrase it because it actually works that way because of what the Act doesn't say, not because of what it does say. So the Act talks about economics everywhere else, doesn't talk about it in that area, and the Supreme Court ruled unanimously that means that economics can't be taken into account there. Anyway, so they're changing fundamental law. They're not just blocking regulations. They're making this central. And I would argue that this, as someone who lived through 95, I sometimes say if someone had told me 1995 was going to be the good old days, I would have shot myself. This actually, instead of waiting for other people to shoot me, this actually is by far a broader, deeper assault. And the sign of that, the sort of emblem of that is a bill that is supposed to come up in the House this fall, which is called the RAINS Act, which would literally put the regulatory system of the United States back to what it was before the Interstate Commerce Commission Act was passed in the 1890s. This bill says that in the future, no major regulation can take effect without Congress voting for it. So it changes an entire rulemaking system that's been in effect for over 100 years with a congressional sweepstakes. This is astounding, and that's the kind, this is, you know, we overuse words like extreme and radical, and I try not to use those for that reason. This, though, is an extreme and radical bill that the Republicans are talking up as their hallmark. Now, a couple of quick other things to, in 95, what happened is after about 5 or 6 months of what now seems like moderate conservatism, there was a backlash both within the Republican ranks and within the public, and that started diminishing. It's going to take longer this time for lots of reasons. We get into that in Q&A because I want to make one set of comments on what Mike said about politics in general. So first of all, Christine O'Donnell lost the election. She is not in the Senate. She lost by a huge margin. It is true that the Republican electorate in the primary in Delaware, which is representative of the Republican electorate in the primary in Delaware and nothing else, voted for Christine O'Donnell. In a general election, where general is significant, where everyone gets to vote, she got trounced. So I don't interpret that as meaning that that nobody supports the Tea Party, but the election certainly doesn't indicate that everybody supports the Tea Party. It is true that moderate Republicans, that all Republicans, are still very worried about Tea Party primaries because of the nature of the Republican electorate. Last point, and on this I'll oddly be the defender of Obama a little bit, and the former Obama administration person is the one attacking, but I would say... we also clearly disagree with the Ozone decision and are especially upset with the way the administration defended it, which we do indeed think is illegal. But in terms of the overall administration posture, first of all, ozone is always the hardest of the ambient air quality standards to get agreement on. The Clinton administration had a very public civil war on it before EPA finally issued regulations in 1997. There's the reason why it's the one where the Bush administration did clearly, we would say, clearly violate the law by not following its own scientific panel. This one is hard. It's not, you can't judge everything from the way this one was handled. The president has been issued very strong veto threats against the regulations that the House has been trying to reverse, which include the ones that Mike listed as things that he thinks they're going to go back on. We think there will be, that we'll see where the greenhouse gas standard schedule ends up. That one hasn't been released yet. And on the Boiler Act one, this is one on industrial boilers that the administration did withdraw. That was because industry gave information later and had withheld it earlier, and therefore, because they actually are bound by the law and need to do their job, EPA is reviewing the standards. Sometimes the whole point of the law is to make these things not purely political, and the law is working that way. I'll stop.
I'm shocked for keeping time, actually. Just a little bit of addendum to David's discussion just for reporters. I think it's really essential, if you're covering any of these bills, to read the legislation, because what you hear on the floor is not what's in the legislation. These just aren't timeouts. If you look at both of the MACT bills, Maximum Achievable Control Technology, the current standard is that these facilities have to achieve maximum achievable control technology, which is actually based on what's happening out there already. The top 12% of those companies that are doing what they're doing, whether it's a cement plant or et cetera, if you just listened to the House Republican debate and did not read that legislation, you would not know that they're requiring the EPA to go back and draft the rules for a least burdensome. That is actually in the statute. So it's going from maximum achievable to least burdensome. And one of the arguments that was being made on the floor was that there's nothing in the real world. These technologies don't exist. Well, actually, they do exist. It's the top 12% of those performing in that industrial sector. So, you know, you have to really read every single, talk to people like David and Lisa too, but just hearing the debates, there's being things left out on either side of the debate.
Can I just throw in one factual thing? So here's an even more subtle but more essential change. They take all the deadlines out of the law. In other words, they basically say there's no time by which EPA needs to do this anymore. That makes the law utterly unenforceable and totally up to political whim, which is goes against the entire reason that environmental law was created. So yes, they're on the one rule, you know, they're doing something narrow on the one proposed rule, but then they've changed the statute to basically make it unenforceable. And that's the kind of thing that even most members, when they're voting on it, despite our best efforts, don't realize.
Okay, next up is David Jenkins of Republicans for Environmental Protection.
Thank you. Before I give my take on the anti-environment binge that many Republican lawmakers and presidential candidates are currently on. I need to be closer. I first want to point out that there's nothing conservative about it. Anyone who studies conservatism should know that stewardship is a fundamental conservative idea. In fact, stewardship is the glue that holds the other tenets of conservatism together. You will find that theme of stewardship and our responsibility to future generations in the writings of great conservative minds like Edmund Burke, Russell Kirk, Richard Weaver. You will find it in the words of Republican presidents like Theodore Roosevelt, Ronald Reagan. Conservatives throughout history have emphasized the importance of environmental protection. I'll read something Margaret Thatcher said. She put it well. She said, "We must remember our duty to nature before it is too late. That duty is constant. It is never completed. It lives on as we breathe. It will weigh on our shoulders for as long as we wish to dwell on a living and thriving planet and hand it on to our children and theirs." Barry Goldwater, Mr. Conservative, put it more bluntly when he wrote, "While I'm a great believer in the free enterprise system and all it entails, I'm an even stronger believer in the right of our people to live in a clean and pollution-free environment." So it's quite frustrating to see anti-environmental positions constantly portrayed in the media as conservative. They're not. These positions most often stem from a mixture of special interest politics, hyper-partisanship, where ideas get demonized based on who embraces them, not what they're about, and the prevalence of radical libertarian views within a segment of the Republican Party. By labeling anti-environmental policies conservative, the media not only gets it wrong, it contributes to the political polarization of environmental issues. Additionally, an odd mixture of partisanship and timidity in media coverage is resulting in more voter confusion by making it harder for them to separate fact from fiction. If you look at those in Congress, Republican or Democrat, who are most often on the attack against environmental regulations, it is lawmakers who are from states with heavy fossil fuel interests or Western libertarian types who resent federal management of public lands. One unique thing about this current anti-environment campaign that House Republican leaders are spearheading is that centrist Republicans have been reluctant to break with leadership on many of these bad environmental votes. The excuse I most often hear is that the member is nervous about casting any vote that will increase the risk of getting a Tea Party-type primary challenger. The oddities of the 2010 election cycle have made them worry more about the GOP primary than the general election. With both parties desperately trying to differentiate themselves from each other on the economy, Republican leaders are gambling that they can sell voters on the notion that environmental regulations are a big drag on the economy. I think this strategy will backfire. First, there's no evidence of such a correlation. Landmark environmental laws like the Clean Air Act have been around for four decades through multiple periods of boom and bust. Secondly, and most importantly, it does not reflect the values of most voters, including Republican voters. Polling shows that hardcore anti-government libertarian types who tend to oppose environmental safeguards represent somewhere between 15 and 20% of Republican voters. It's a vocal 15 to 20%, but even so, that only takes you so far in a general election. There's been much polling over the years showing that a majority of Republican voters support strong environmental protections. In a poll conducted last year for REP, 86% of self-identified conservatives said that they believe conserving natural resources and environmental stewardship are conservative values. A poll announced just last week by CERES and conducted jointly by Republican and Democrat polling firms found that 58% of Republicans oppose congressional efforts to stop EPA from enacting new limits on air pollution from power plants, as do 85% of independents. A poll released in advance of a key Endangered Species Act vote this summer showed 73% of Republicans support the ESA, and on that vote, we actually did see 37 House Republicans break ranks and defend the act. Some polling does indicate that many Americans currently feel there's too much regulation on business, but that view does not seem to translate into opposition to specific environmental laws. And even though the environment is not a top concern for most voters right now, clean air, clean water, and quality interaction with the natural environment are expected by most Americans, regardless of their political stripes. Greg Strimple, the Republican pollster who helped with the CERES poll, nicely articulated the political risk for Republicans in opposing air quality rules. He said, "I advise my political candidates that you need to find issues that unite the Republican Party with the center of the electorate and divide Democrats. And this issue does the opposite. This issue unites the center of the electorate with the left side of the Democrats and divides Republicans. Simply saying no to environmental safeguards is a losing proposition. Republicans would be far wiser to embrace the strong stewardship ethic that is inherent in traditional conservatism. They can do that and still differentiate themselves from Democrats by working to conserve natural resources and offering traditionally conservative solutions to today's environmental problems.
Thank you, David. Next up is Steve Brown, Environmental Council of the States.
So first of all, let me tell you what the Environmental Council of the States is. I have 52 members. They're the men and women that run the state environmental agencies. They're the people that implement all these rules and laws. And to give you an idea how that works, 96% of what can be implemented to the states has been implemented to the states. That's clean air, clean water, RCRA, safe drinking water, and some other stuff too, for that matter. We take 90% of all the enforcement actions. We do almost all the inspections. 94% of the data in EPA's six biggest databases came from the states. It's the second biggest data flow next to the IRS. And we issue nearly all the permits. So EPA doesn't implement environmental policy in this country. The states do. They do it under federal law. And what's happened is we get lots of new rules and less money every year to implement them. And this is not sustainable, and it's going to break sooner or later. In the past 5 years, we've gotten 266 significant new rules that we are required to implement. That's over 50 a year. And if you want to see a list of them, it's in regulatorygateway.gov. Regulatorygateway.gov. It may just be reggateway.gov, but you'll find it. So let's talk for a second about the cuts. So since 2004, we've had a steady decline in federal money that goes to the states through EPA's budget. And since 2008, we've had a steady decline in state money because of the state problems. It's not, they don't just single out environment. In fact, sometimes environment actually gets a little bit better deal than the other agencies. But it's been a steady decline. And so we actually, if you factor in inflation, we actually have less money now than we did in 2000. And yet we've had about 50 new rules a year since 2000. So you do the math on that and see what. By the way, nothing ever gets taken off the table. We never have an environmental rule that we say, we're done with that when we've accomplished it. We don't have to do it anymore. Everything is just additive. We almost never oppose the rules. There's one we've opposed in the last 5 years. But all the rest of them, we're fine on implementing them. But the question is, how are they going to get implemented with the declines in the funds? So when Congress cuts EPA's budget, you look at the numbers. They're not cutting EPA. The money that gets cut is the money that goes to the states. In fact, during the Bush administration 1 year, 105% of the cut went to states. That is to say, EPA actually kept some of our money in order to increase their own funding at the expense of the states. Under the Obama administration, it's been a little bit better. Only 75% of the cuts to EPA actually go to the states. What does this mean? It means that when you couple that up with the cuts that states have had on their own side, here's some typical things that I hear from my members. I've lost 10% of my air inspectors. I've lost 40 of my field staff. I have to lay off 15% of my work staff. I just hear these all the time, and hopefully we're getting near the end of that. But we have flattened ourselves down. We've leaned ourselves as far as we can be leaned. We're running out of options, and every time we get a new rule, we don't say we don't want to implement it. We say, how are we going to implement it? And what's going to start to happen? It's already begun to happen. States have said, we're not going to do it when you want it done. We're going to put it on the list. We'll get to it when we get to it. So it's not transparent to the public. New rules with no money is not environmental protection.
Thanks, Steve. And last but not least, Michael Bruhn, who's the executive director of the Sierra Club.
Thanks, Dina. Morning, everyone. My good colleague, Mike McKenna, started the conversation, for those of you who came in a little bit late, asking the question, why now? And so I'd like to offer my own answer to that, which is to make it, to bring it into the reality that most Americans across the country are facing. Right now, half of Americans every day are breathing air that's unsafe to breathe. Think about that. Half of Americans, when they go outside and they breathe, which most of Americans are fond of doing, are breathing air that is unhealthy. How many people here have asthma? Just a couple. Okay, fortunate lot. If you want to know what it feels like to have asthma, take a deep breath, and then take a deep breath through a straw. That's what it's like to live with asthma every day. If you want to know what it feels like to have an asthma attack, jog in place for 2 minutes, take that straw and pinch it in the middle, and then breathe through it. That's what an asthma attack is like. One out of 10 American children suffer from asthma across the country. African American kids, 1 out of 6 suffer from asthma. Mercury poisoning. Mercury is a potent brain poison. It disrupts your ability to learn. Mercury is produced, the largest source of mercury is from the burning of coal, coal-fired power plants across the country. Largest source of mercury comes from coal. It's entirely unregulated. In 1990, which was 21 years ago, the Clean Air Act was finalized in which mercury was supposed to be regulated. 21 years later, we still don't have any effective regulation of mercury from utilities across the country. So this is part of the reason why EPA is beginning to enact these safeguards to protect our air and protect our water. And it's also the reason why we're seeing what is demonstrably true, which is the largest rollback of environmental regulations, the largest attempted rollback in the U.S. Congress of environmental regulations in our country's history. We are living through the largest congressional assault on our air and on our water in our country's history. The other reason why this is happening is because we're making progress. Under the Obama administration, we've seen dramatic regulations to increase fuel economy and reduce emissions from automobiles, cars, trucks, SUVs across the country. This has already been signed into law. We're also seeing the second round of these CAR rules covering vehicles from 2017 to 2025, which will bring fuel economy up to 55 miles per gallon. We're making more progress in just a few years than has been made in the last few generations, or last few decades, last few decades on fuel economy. At the same time, we're seeing heavy-duty trucks regulated for the first time ever in our country's history. And probably bigger than any of that, we're seeing the U.S. electric sector, the power sector, being held to modern pollution standards. Over the last few years, 154 new coal-fired power plants proposals have been defeated. And over the last 18 months, the Sierra Club, Earth Justice, literally hundreds of small, large, medium, NRDC, hundreds of organizations have worked together to lock in the closure of existing coal-fired power plants that don't have modern pollution controls, that don't have a way to limit the air pollution and water pollution coming from their facilities. Since January 1st of 2010 to the middle of October of this year, we've locked in the retirement of 10% of the U.S. coal fleet. The Sierra Club has a goal to retire at least a third of U.S. coal plants, to lock in the retirement of at least a third of the U.S. coal plants in our country by the end of 2015. And we expect to meet that goal and we'll exceed it, and replace those plants with clean energy. So the reason why EPA is enacting these rules is because they work, they protect public health, they create jobs, and they save money. And the reason why you're seeing assaults on the EPA is because Republicans in Congress and their corporate benefactors are worried about the threat to the status quo in the energy industry. There's no other reason. There's no other reason why this is happening. The only reason why you're seeing this assault on Congress is because we're making progress in weaning ourselves from dirty energy, we're making progress in scaling up clean energy, and that threatens the profits of the coal industry and the oil industry and the representatives in Congress that they sponsor. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Michael. I'm going to go right to questions because I have the privilege of talking to these people quite a bit. So who has the first question? Working journalists first. Please limit it to a question, not a statement. There's a lot of people in this room. There's six panelists. So short and sweet. And who has the first question? And I'm going to ask the panel. I'll repeat the question, and if you can identify a panelist to start. Okay, just I need to repeat. I'm sorry, guys, for the recording. So I'm going to make it shorter. Sorry. So the latest rhetoric out of the GOP, it seems to be an anti-establishment science. Can you all react to what the questioner called intellectual dishonesty or fraudulence?
Care who goes first? John Huntsman said about the Republican Party, and he said it recently, actually, we cannot become the anti-science party and win in the election. We can be successful as a party. We cannot do that. And we very much agree with that. I think what you're seeing with this sort of anti-science thing is you're seeing the influence of a media culture with talk radio and Fox News and so forth, where there's a segment of the public that if they don't believe something, they don't have to face facts in the news every day that challenge their beliefs. They just go to the news source that is going to be tailor-made to their own views. And I think you see that having an impact with some of the folks on Capitol Hill. And I think that's why you're seeing that there's so much now of sort of ignoring the science. A good example is the light bulb thing where they're trying to roll back these light bulbs. The rumor was that we're going to have to go to compact fluorescence. Well, this rumor was able to take traction in the American public, at least enough to scare members of Congress, even though the incandescent bulbs that meet the standard are on the shelf at Home Depot right now for $1.50. So something is happening where people are not getting the kind of information they need, and of course that filters up to the debate in Congress. So we need to solve that problem.
One aspect of this is that, I mean, this is really the debate going on in Congress, and it's interesting that, again, they've chosen to sort of make environment in some ways the marquee issue, but it is a deep philosophical, ideological divide about the nature of the world and the purpose of government. And, you know, one concern I've got is a lot of times these debates are undercovered on the theory that, well, you know, the House stuff isn't going to get signed into law anyway. Well, first of all, it still changes sort of the nature of the debate in D.C. When they end up in appropriations bills, it leads to shutdowns, or at least threats of shutdowns. By the way, I mean, the one political message from the shutdown standoff back in the spring was the administration and the Senate finally said, just get these riders out of there, these anti-environmental provisions, we're not taking them. And the administration has not suffered politically for that by anybody's measure. So, you know, there is no problem with standing up to this if you make the case. But there's this deep ideological divide, and this is the choice the American people are going to have in the next election cycle. And it's really important for people to understand these folks are deadly in earnest. You know, the American public's notion of, can't you all get along? The answer is no. There's actually not now, because you do not have, you have one side that's really got a very hardline ideological agenda, which includes meaning that they will reject scientific consensus and they'll try to substitute for it their own sense of science if their ideology is trampled on, is crossed, especially in the area of climate, which has now begun to infect other areas. You know, one way to summarize part of what Dave said was, you know, conservatism doesn't kill environmentalism, conservatives kill environmentalism. And, you know, it's these folks who claim to be conservatives that are really, they have this agenda, and the public needs to understand there is actually a choice. This is kind of the way, to some degree, the political system or elections should work. You've got a defined choice between two absolutely opposite views of the world, and people need to understand that this is not some joke, that this is, you know, that there's a real agenda here. The last thing I'll say on the science is conservatives on climate, where, again, this is really where the main scientific conflict is. Conservatives decided long ago, which they didn't have to, that they would fight this on the grounds of whether the phenomenon existed. And they basically said, you know, if, you know, by at least by implication, if this were real, we'd have to do something about it. And they didn't want to do something about it. And so there could be an argument about what you should do about it, what economic consequences there are, how to define a system, all the things that you would think would happen now. You don't have to fight it on the science. They made a decision that if they lost the scientific battle, they'd lose the whole thing. And that's why the scientific battle has been so fierce.
Hey, Mike McKenna, I want to jump in here.
I'm sorry, what was the question again?
God almighty. What was the question?
Why is the GOP embracing anti-establishment science, going against science?
What do you have in mind?
That's the question.
Yeah. I don't do good on hypotheticals. I didn't go to college like all these guys. I'm having a little trouble connecting the specific to anything I know.
Okay, let me jump in here, Mike.
Yeah.
So let's talk about the MACT, the MACT material technology for cement plants and boilers and the delays on... that would delay regulations to control air toxics and mercury, and which many GOP lawmakers, which you know, have been on the floor questioning the EPA's cost-benefit analysis on that and the benefits of those. Start there.
No, let me correct one thing. Nobody's questioning the benefits. What they're questioning is how the benefits have been counted. Are we counting them correctly? I don't know anybody who thinks, yeehaw, we're emitting more mercury, sign me up. But they want to know, hey, is this counting legitimate? Lisa Jackson in the Los Angeles Times this morning attacks the Republicans for being in favor of dirtier air and dirtier water and all that kind of good stuff, right? But interestingly, she left out the number of lives saved, the mortality and morbidity avoided due to EPA regulatory efforts. Now, that has been a pretty constant feature of the landscape, right down to an email response from EPA to Erica Martinson at Politico 4 days ago. It's like you pull that string and EPA says, we're saving 17,000 lives or 36,000 lives or whatever, whatever, whatever. What that tells me is that Administrator Jackson understands, hey, you know what? We might not be counting this totally right. With respect to climate, reasonable people disagree. Does it cause damage? Is it going to cause damage to the brand in the future? Maybe. Who knows? What's going to happen tomorrow? I'd get hit by a truck tomorrow. I mean, you know, you're asking me again a hypothetical. Do people worry about it now? No. Well, let me ask you a question. You know, everybody was so hot on ethanol 10 years ago. Did that? Let me stop. I'm sorry. Let me restate that. The administration and Congress were all hot on ethanol 10 years ago. Did it damage anybody's brand, like when we've got years of accumulated evidence now that it's not very good for anything? I don't think so. I mean, the great thing about America, and the bad thing about America is, attention spans about 30 seconds.
So can I comment on that before people forget it then? First, I'll actually agree with Mike. Some of these things aren't disputing science. I mean, if people want to have a debate about whether cost-benefit analysis is correct or not, to me, that's legitimate. I mean, we think one thing, they may think another, but that's not a not believing in science thing. But there have been members on the Republican side in the House that have started raising questions about, does anyone really get harmed by mercury? That's disputing the science. On particles, to use Stan's example, having a debate over whether we should have specific regs on fine particles, perfectly legitimate. Again, we're in one place, I assume Mike's in another. Debating whether fine particles actually cause mortality, which actually the Bush administration changed their entire sense of how to regulate particles because they were convinced by the evidence that absolutely they're probably one of the most dangerous pollutants out there in terms of deaths. That's the science part. So I think, you know, you've got to separate these things. One of the things that's happening, it had just been in the climate area, but it is starting to slip into other areas where people are questioning long-established science in this area. That doesn't mean doesn't happen just when people question whether a reg is a good idea or not. That's a legitimate political question. So I think we need to separate those things out. But there is this undermining, I'd say, on climate. Can argue about which people are reasonable, but there's a pretty good consensus on the fact that the problem exists. If you want to talk about how bad will the climate get over what period of time where, that reasonable scientists can have an argument about.
Can I just say one thing in this debate? The idea of the attack on science is always an essential argument against environmental regulation. If you look back at the intellectual history of environmental policy in this country, that is always part of the argument, and you can see why. Because nobody wants dirtier air or dirtier water. Nobody wants that. There's something so compelling about the environmental argument that a piece of the argument must be that there's no risk, always.
Can I just put in a plug, especially since Paul's back there, reminds me. When I was between the Hill and NRDC, I worked on a study for the Bipartisan Policy Center. You can find it on their website. So the Science for Policy Project, it was co-chaired by then former Congressman Bullard and Don Kennedy, the former editor of Science, had a big bipartisan group on exactly how to deal with the kinds of procedurally with some of the issues that Lisa just mentioned.
Okay, next question. Steve?
Steve Farrell, you're from Living on Air Public Radio International. So this last election, we saw the Tea Party step up. Now we're seeing the Occupy movement really step up. We've seen the demonstrations against Keystone. We saw, in fact, the former head of the Presidential Council of Environmental Quality arrested in front of the White House on the Keystone dispute. So from your perspectives, what's happening now in America politically on the environment? Where will the Occupy movement push the environmental debate and the elections that are coming up?
Where will the Occupy movement push the environmental debates and the elections coming up? Although I think that Steve was loud enough, but who wants to take that?
I'll start. Maybe I shouldn't. First of all, I mean, I would agree with Dave. There's lots of evidence showing that at base, public still supports environmental protections, hasn't really focused, partly because it's been undercovered, on the extent of the rollbacks. Yes, there's always, you know, ambivalence about regulation, but in the end, when people look at what regulations do on the specifics, they tend to back it. And the fact that Congress is the venue where these are being rolled back doesn't increase the level of public support, let's put it that way. You know, the Occupy movement, I mean, it does show there's frustration out there. I mean, the question about the Occupy movement is, does it start focusing on an actual political agenda? And, you know, they're dealing with fundamentally political issues. One of the things that disturbs me about the current state of American politics is that while in Washington everything is polarized and people are having what they view as this life and death battle, most of the public, while equally polarized, has sort of given up on politics. And I don't think that there is no way to solve public problems without politics. And I think you need to start focusing on politics again. And so the question is, not just is the Occupy movement, you know, for a lot of different things, but will they eventually focus on the fact that the way you change things is politics? There's nothing inherently dirty about it. There is no alternative. This sort of flight from politics is not a way to run a country in any area. And that, to me, is the fundamental question.
And Michael Bruno.
So I think there's a lot of ways to influence society, and politics is one important way. So I'd say that the Occupy movement already has a political agenda. It is saying that corporate policies, by and large, and certainly public policies, don't work for average folks. They don't work in the economic sphere. They don't work socially, and they don't work for community development, and they certainly don't work for the environment. Regarding where the Occupy movement goes next, Steve, for your question, as it relates to environmental issues, we can look at what's happened in the last couple weeks, where several hundred people from Occupy Wall Street came down for the U.S. State Department hearings on the Keystone XL pipeline. They actually occupied the State Department so that the Sierra Club and other environmental groups could have the first say at the public hearing the next day. And it had actually a profound impact because literally what happened is we had all these folks come down from New York City, go to Washington, D.C., and camp out overnight at the State Department. The purpose of that was because There were a number of union members who were given the day off, who were paid to go to those hearings. And many of these union members with whom the Sierra Club and other environmental groups work really closely with had never heard before the environmental impacts of the Keystone XL pipeline. And after sitting there and hearing testimony from Sierra Club and NRDC and Earth Justice and dozens of different environmental groups, farmers in Nebraska, ranchers down in Texas, many of them contacted us or came up to us afterward wanting to work more closely together. What you'll see next, a very specific next step coming from the Occupy movement, is that many of them will be coming down for the rallies on November 6th, which the Sierra Club, again, NRDC, Bill McKibben and 350.org, and several dozen organizations are sponsoring a large rally around the White House to urge the president to reject the Keystone XL pipeline. The other thing that I think you'll see, and this is one way in which private politics plays an important role in shaping society, is you'll start to see the Occupy movement, which has now grown to more than 1,500 locations across the country. You'll start to see this movement working to challenge and inspire corporate America to establish strong policies. There's been a strong record in the last over the last decade or so where corporate policies on issues like forest protection, water protection, other issues have helped to set a political context where Congress can then take action. So what you may see is if we can't get really strong progress coming from inside the Beltway, you'll see leading companies starting to take the lead in reducing their own emissions, increasing their purchases of clean energy, doing things to protect the environment that will then help to provide a political context for broader and deeper change.
Thanks, Michael. Lisa?
This is an excellent question, and I just want to offer one insight and one example. The insight is that I think that the Occupy movement and the environmental movement are philosophically fellow travelers in the following sense. I think they both care a great deal about the imposition of large risks by very few on very many. The imposition of large risks by very few on very many. Here's my example. The very many of the most controversial rules apply to power plants. They are the utility hazardous air pollutants rule, the so-called MATS rule, the new source performance standards on greenhouse gases, the rule relating to cooling water structures, and on down the line. There are several rules, the most controversial. They comprise what members of Congress who are against the rules call the so-called train wreck. And here's the example that I want to offer that makes them fellow travelers, which is there are only a few power plants, relatively speaking, that are in the bullseye of all of those rules. Something like, I want to say, 100, maybe it's 200, but that's in the entire country. Those are facilities, in my view, the question is, why aren't they a train wreck in the other direction? These are facilities that are imposing along every human health and environmental dimension risks that are enormous. Air, water, land, you name it, they impose the risk. Very few plants, very many people. It's an example of a place where I think these two movements have very sympathetic aims.
Can I just add?
Can I just offer a homework assignment for you? What are those plants? Where are they?
I'll just add that, you know, with both the Tea Party and the Occupy Wall Street, I think they have parts of their message that can resonate to broader America. With the Tea Party, I think it was fiscal discipline. I think a lot of people really felt that we were just spinning our way too fast into too deep of a hole. With Occupy Wall Street, I think it's what she said is that, you know, there's too much political power concentrated with a few. And I don't think these movements in themselves will last. I think they will all peter out. But I think they're emblemic of the fact that if you poll people's satisfaction with Congress, it's at an all-time low. And if you look at 2006, they kicked the Republicans out. You look at 2008, they kicked the Republicans out. You look at 2010, they kicked the Democrats out. This is a revolving door is because of dissatisfaction with leadership. The first party that gets the clue that they need to reach across the aisle and they need to work on solutions that solve America's problems and not play so much politics,
I think will actually build a majority. But until then, I think you're going to continue to see a revolving door, and you're going to see these kind of movements as manifestations of people's dissatisfaction.
Next question.
Yeah. Well.
So let me just repeat the question briefly. Okay. So the question deals with kind of the either-or choice between jobs and clean air and clean water that the GOP is putting out there, and he wants your comment on that. And maybe Mike McKenna, you can chime in on that too.
Yeah,
and the current talking point, job killer.
Yeah. Well, you find that, I think, for two reasons. One is this is always the argument that industry uses when it's opposing any kind of regulation. It's going to kill jobs. I mean, I've worked with pulp and paper things where these regulations, we're going to have to lay everybody off, but then the regulations go into effect, nobody gets laid off. So you hear this argument constantly. It's a question of who buys it, and right now Republicans in Congress are buying it and trying to peddle it. The other thing is you have people in Congress who are trying to advocate for certain agendas. Well, depending on what the hot issue of the day is where they're going to gravitate. So right now the concern on Americans' minds is jobs. So, of course, magically, drilling here will solve the job problem. Letting this pollution go on will solve the job problem. Everything, so they're always working angles, and they always gravitate toward those angles. So that's why you see that. Of course, we know that, usually doesn't stand the test of scrutiny, but because, American public, goes about their lives and they're not going to sit there and read the report, probably, I think they can sell that. And until they're proven, it's proven otherwise, you'll keep hearing this mantra.
Anyone else, Mike?
Yeah, sure. I think the Republicans' argument is tremendously helped on both the Utility MAC and the Boiler MAC, and Keystone for that matter, by the fact that the relevant unions are all on the Republican side, right? Mm-hmm. On the Utility MAC and the Boiler MAC, it's the Boilermakers and the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers and AMWA, right, the United Mine Workers. And on the Keystone, it's the pipe fitters and the Teamsters and I suppose the steel workers, right? So, if you're looking for somebody who's counter-narrative, you have a situation where the Republicans and the unions are not in lockstep, but on more or less the same side. And I know what's about to be said, so let me just see if I can short-circuit it, right? The petitions on Casper included two of those unions, and if the third union hadn't been lazy and inefficient, it would have included three unions. And the pro-petitions, the docket on Keystone, has all three of those unions in saying you should build the thing. Sorry, go ahead.
Can I just go in on that?
Just briefly, if you think Republican science is bad, Republican economics are worse. The numbers that get circulated in Washington, D.C. on the costs of rules and the economic effects of rules are ridiculous. They don't withstand the most glancing scrutiny. There was circulated and still is circulated a figure that regulation costs $1.75 trillion a year. That is a ridiculous number. It has absolutely no basis in fact, and yet it's been circulated as if it's the truth. It's based on, among other things, an equation that wasn't intended for that purpose and on rules that do not exist.
Okay.
Yeah.
We're right.
Okay, I'll be quick. Appreciate Lisa's comments. And I just wanted to say I think it's a little dangerous for Mike to say that Republicans and unions are in lockstep.
I didn't. That's exactly what I did.
When talking about any of those particular rules that you said as well, because what we're finding is that there is a substantial portion of the labor movement on Casper and on Mercury and on Keystone XL Pipeline that have come out in favor of Casper and Mercury, and it's also come out opposed to the Keystone XL pipeline. And what you also have, I'll finish my point, is a large portion of the labor movement that is now organized and mobilized in defense of clean jobs, jobs that now outnumber what you'll find in dirty energy industries, right? So the reason why you're seeing more and more labor support is because they know that the growth is coming from clean energy jobs.
No doubt. Just to amend the transcript and make sure it's clean, that is precisely what I avoided saying. They are not in lockstep. They are pointed in the same direction as what I said.
So just to build on Lisa's point and a little historical and economic. So a couple of things here. I mean, one is studies of all the sort of meta studies of regulation and jobs, not environmental regulation, regulation as a whole, find that regulation has a neutral to positive effect on jobs. So there's just no evidence that regulations as a whole are affecting jobs negatively. Secondly, you know, there's every study, well, I don't know about it. The main study that people cite on costs, exactly what Lisa said, the costs that are estimated in advance of a rule when compared to what actually ends up being the case, the costs at the beginning are wildly exaggerated for two reasons. One is that they tend to come from people who have an interest in using the maximum estimate. And the other is they all assume that technology doesn't change because we're not good at modeling new technology. And so there's an economic bias. Even if everyone was being intellectually honest, there's an economic bias. And so it usually turns out to be that way. The car manufacturers said that seatbelt rules would put them out of business. They were right about having business problems. They're a few years off, but it wasn't because of seatbelts. And unions have changed in this, too. UAW used to oppose the kinds of fuel economy standards that Mike mentioned at the beginning. Now they see that they're a lifeline. And so that's the fact that a labor union is on one side or another, and as both in the end, both Mike's ended acknowledging, the labor movement is split on some of these things, doesn't mean that in the long term, labor isn't helped by having these kinds of rules. Then the Republicans, again, the Tea Party at least, goes well beyond suggesting that we need to stop these particular rules because there'll be immediate short-term job impact. Some of these members start talking as if this recession was caused by environmental rules. I mean, which is almost, you know, total fantasy. And if you want to make any argument about this particular recession and rules, it's that if you need a case study of how an absolutely unregulated or actually underregulated market can actually be bad for the economy, you just have to look at what happened in the last years. Sadly, we don't have to look back to the 30s anymore to see that lesson.
Steve's going to comment next, then I'm going to get to your question, okay? Just for those in the room that don't know what CSAPR is, Cross-State Air Pollution Rule, which was the Obama's administration's replacement to George Bush's Clean Air Interstate Rule, which deals with pollution blowing downwind from primarily coal-fired power plants, just an acronym check.
Right, and a rule that many utilities actually support.
So. I actually hadn't heard CSAPR. I was like, so Steve, to you.
So it's easy to find silliness on cost-benefit ratios from anywhere. We've been arguing with EPA for the last 5 years that they should include as part of the cost of every new regulation the administrative cost of states to implement the rule, and they refuse to do it. Now, look, we're not interested in messing up cost-benefit ratios. We're not trying to argue our way out of having a rule promulgated. But what we are saying is you ought to be fair about the way that you estimate what the costs are. You ought to include the real costs. Even OMB guidance says they ought to include the cost. Why won't they include that cost? I don't know. They won't do it, though.
The question is about corporate influence on environmental policy. Mike McKenna, do you want to start with that?
No. But I will. Here's the problem, right? And it's persistent across all functions of the federal government: healthcare, telecom, oil and gas, financial services, right? The technology and the processes have become so complicated that the only people who understand them are the people who do them every day. What that means is if you're EPA trying to write a Boiler Mac, was it David, did you say that the Boiler Mac was stayed, or at least it was you? Somebody said the Boiler Mac was stayed because the utilities came up with information late.
I said that.
I'm sorry, not the utilities, the rate. Was that you? That tells you everything you need to know. There's nobody at EPA who understands what they're regulating on a day-to-day basis, just like there's very few people at the SEC who understand what they're regulating, precious few people at HHS who understand what they're regulating. They rely on the people who know what they're doing. And for almost everything of any complexity, the people who know what they're doing
are already working in the business. And we can pretend that's not the way it is. We can talk about that's not the way it is. But the reality of it is, that's the way it is. Nobody here on this panel could run a power plant. Nobody here on this panel could run a paper mill. Nobody here on this panel could run an offshore rig. And if we're going to talk intelligently about it, everybody here will tell you the truth. They call up people who do. It's all derivative. And that's a real problem. I don't have a solution.
No. I said nobody on this panel.
Are we going down the list?
Yeah, we can go down.
I'm just as likely to walk out of a congressional office or walk into one and see somebody from an environmental group coming out as I am see somebody from industry coming out. Seems balanced to me. Everybody gets to say their word. They're there. If they're not effective, it's not their issue.
Okay, guys, I just wanted to say, like, out of respect, let's not have a peanut gallery.
I think this is an extremely troubling problem. I think that the influence of corporations on environmental policy is huge. I think that one of the most insidious places where they influence environmental policy is at what we've already talked about a couple of times, which is on science, where a few years ago the industry decided, and this is, I'm going to paraphrase, but this is well quoted, you can find it in very easily, to reposition global warming as a hypothesis rather than a fact. They took it straight from the pages of the tobacco industry. I don't think that's a good example for them to set. So all I can say is time is short, but I think it's an extremely difficult and scary kind of problem.
Yeah, I mean, I think there is some truth to what Mike said down there. There is a level of knowledge and intimacy with the regulations and stuff that occur within industry that has to abide by them and that knows the processes. The problem is you still have this scenario. You can't rely on them totally because you got the fox guarding the hen house. We've seen what some of these relationships can morph into with the former... what's Buy More Now is the Mineral Management Service. I mean, it can get really bad, and so you don't have effective regulation. So there needs to be more balance, and I think it's too easy a lot of times for regulators and for members of Congress to just listen to the industry and their views and not listen to what the public wants on the other end. And I think the other aspect of this is campaign finance laws and more sunshine on who donates what to who. Because I think that's an important part of balancing this scale so that you don't always have the most money and the most direct interest in charge of all the decision making.
So, I mean, I think there's certainly the case to be made for industry influence. Lisa made it. I'm sure Mike's about to. So let me make a couple of slightly different points. One, that are presumably complementary with those. One, to get to Mike's point, whether that's true or not, and it actually is largely true, that's actually a different issue than, I think, influence in Congress about making broad policy decisions on whether we're going to actually try, as Lisa said, to limit what a small group of powerful industries can do. That's different from the technical issue of who has expertise for rulemaking. Second issue, there's a problem here not only of money but also of ideology. And again, I mean, I urge people to be writing about this, incredible ideological swing and the impact, because I think most of the public don't understand how significant that is. And actually, again, going back to this RAINS Act, that would actually make it really hard for industry to give the expertise to the agencies, because everything would go to the who's going to have the political influence question in Congress. And one of the things that's happening now is not only that industry sometimes excessively drives the political world, but the ideologues drive industry. And so because the Republican Party, especially in the House, is controlled now by a small group of hard right people, industry is afraid to differ from them, even when it's not in industry's interest to actually have these. And the only time you've seen the split is when industry finally got scared to death and realized, you know what, these guys are serious about the government going to default. And suddenly the Business Roundtable wrote a letter saying, whoa, what the hell are you doing? I didn't know you were serious. And that has to happen, frankly, on the environmental area, too, because there's this huge industry problem that people have talked about, but compared to the Tea Party types, industry is pragmatic. And part of the problem is there's this sort of dangerous cycle now where each is driving the other in a way that isn't in the public interest or even in industry's interest.
All right. Thanks, David. So speaking at the end of the panel, it's hard to say something that's new. So I would say, yeah, it is a huge problem, obviously, and it has multiple pieces to it. One is, as you mentioned, the revolving door between lobbyists and folks working on the Hill or in the administration or in state houses across the country. What we also have as a huge problem, as David Jenkins mentioned, the huge influx of political cash into the process, exacerbated by Citizens United, which not only is increasing the amount of money going into the political system and the electoral system, but it's also it's allowing for large amounts of undisclosed money to come in and dramatically corrupt the process. And so I think some of the remedies to this are, first, in the political process, in addition to campaign finance reform, there's this old saying in politics that there are two things that are important in elections. One is money, and then, as the saying goes, the person says, and I forget what the second thing is, right? Well, the second thing is people. And so groups like the Sierra Club or groups who work on electoral issues, we are not going to be able to outspend some of our opponents. We're not going to be able to outspend the Koch brothers, despite whatever large donations we might get. But what we do have is we've got millions of people who work with the Sierra Club and who work as part of the environmental movement who have to outwork and out-innovate and outsmart some of our opponents. So one piece is to energize the public to engage. The second part of it has to be some sort of revocation of Citizens United and deeper, more stricter, intelligent campaign finance reform to reinstate democracy in the country because it's being polluted and corrupted. And then I do have to respond to my good colleague on the other end of the spectrum or table. And say, there are intelligent people who work outside of corporate America, and there are people who are able to regulate industries who don't come from industries. It's not impossible for someone who isn't embedded within the fossil fuel industry to hold that industry to tough standards. So to suggest that the only people who can do this are those who are currently embedded in the industry is just not accurate.
I know you guys have a lot more questions. Unfortunately, we're out of time, but let me just end on a journalistic note. This is where we are essential, because as you cover these rollbacks, I did the cement max last week. I asked the EPA for all the cement plants. I overlaid the congressional districts. I told AP readers where those cement plants were. And each of you who covers a state or a region, ask yourself when that lawmaker sponsors a bill or votes for a bill that rolls back EPA rules, say mercury, how much mercury is going into the air in their district? And they're rolling back ozone. Where are they on ozone standards? Are they in violation? How many code orange? How many code red days? I think it's a really interesting question to ask as journalists is, who is the constituent here? Is it the cement plant in your district, the coal fire power plant in your district, or the people breathing the air in your district? So that's where we can fill the void, not just write about, what these guys are saying and he said, she said. So I just want to end on that note. Thank you all for coming. Thanks for this great panel. Enjoy the rest of SCJ.